Activists, Black Lives Matter demonstrators, and U.S. officials marked the killing of George Floyd with memorial events and marches around the country. The members of the victim's family met with President Joe Biden. In New York, civil rights activist Reverend Al Sharpton and several other officials, including the city's mayor Bill de Blasio, gathered and kneeled in a symbolic move to remember the black man's murder.
As we want to dramatize to the world the insensitivity and outright total lack of any concern that this officer had, he put his knee on the neck of George Floyd for 9 minutes and 29 seconds. And you've got to have a lot of disregard for the law, disregard for human being, to have something throbbing under you that long.
During the memorial, de Blasio slammed the persistent U.S. police brutality and racism.
How do you forget someone's humanity? Well, because for 400 years in this country, the persistent, obsessive training was to tell white people not to value black lives. It was everywhere you turned. And it poisoned the memory to that officer. What he did disgusts me to this hour of this day.
More than 150 years after the 13th Amendment abolished slavery in the U.S., opinion polls show most American adults believe the legacy of slavery continues to have an impact on the position of black people in society. Following the murder of Floyd, Americans and people around the world ramped up calls to root out law enforcement misconduct and violence against black people. After a year, the divided U.S. Congress still struggles to find a compromise to pass a federal bill in response to the ongoing controversial methods of policing. The 46-year-old Floyd was killed in Minneapolis by white former officer Derek Chauvin, who was convicted last month of murder. While the conviction of Chauvin, who faces up to 40 years in prison, marked a new chapter in the U.S., incidents of similar nature have nevertheless persisted in the country ever since. A year after the brutal murder, activists say measures taken by some jurisdictions, which have been on the books for years, are insufficient to address the issue of systematic racism in the U.S. criminal justice system.
Yemeni people and government officials headed to Hamas office in Yemen's capital Sana'a to extend their congratulations to Palestinians for their historic victory over the Israeli regime and to express solidarity with Palestinians against any new Israeli aggression.
We in the Hamas movement live here among our Yemeni brothers who share with us the joy of victory, and this is something expected from the Yemeni people. This victory was achieved thanks to God and thanks to the efforts of the brothers in the resistance axis, including Yemenis. We share the same goal and vision with the Yemeni people who made the issue of Palestine one of their top priorities despite being involved in a deadly war by Saudi Arabia and its allies.
The Yemenis called on the Palestinian resistance to continue its armed struggle against Israel. They also thanked Iran for its open support for Palestinians' resistance groups.
We came here to congratulate our Palestinian brothers on this great victory that delighted the Yemenis and all the free people of the world. This victory was clinched with the blessing of God and the great support of Iran, and it was a confirmation of our unified stance against our common enemy Israel, who was defeated in this battle. The resistance groups must continue their armed struggle until the liberation of all occupied lands.
Israel killed hundreds of civilians, including women and children, in its war on Gaza and its deadly crackdown on Palestinians on the occupied West Bank earlier this month. Palestinian resistance groups responded by hitting the Israeli occupied territories with hundreds of rockets, which forced the regime to declare a unilateral ceasefire.
Yemenis say the ongoing Saudi war on their country told them that armed struggle is the only way to stand against aggressors. They believe that Palestinians are on the right path to regaining their territories from the Israeli occupation. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Israeli forces have escalated their arrest campaigns throughout the occupied territories as a fragile ceasefire halts in the besieged Gaza Strip following an 11-day Israeli airstrikes on the enclave. Tens of Palestinians were detained by Israeli forces in raids across the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem Al-Quds early Monday. The Palestinian Prisoner Club Association expects more arrests to be reported within the coming days.
Israel's occupation project has not ended yet. These arrests are aimed at draining the energy of the Palestinian people who are determined to resist Israel. The Israeli authorities think that by adopting aggressive measures, they can refrain the consciousness of the Palestinian people.
Over the past days, Israeli forces have arrested hundreds of Palestinians in lands occupied in 1948. Moreover, the Israeli police announced it arrested 1,550 Palestinians in the past 2 weeks in areas such Haifa, Yaffa, Lod, Ramli, and Kfar Kanna, towns in occupied lands amid tension over Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip. These areas have witnessed the protests against Israeli aggression on Palestinians in East Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and the Gaza Strip. These protests have been attacked by both the Israeli police and settlers, and many of the Palestinians' shops and vehicles have been smashed.
Israel tries to oppress the Palestinians through arresting them so that they can't remain united in their resistance against the Israeli occupation.
Tension escalated across the Palestinian territory since last month over Israel's attempt to ethnically cleanse Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in Jerusalem Al-Quds from Palestinian families in favor of settlement groups. The situation flared up after Israeli forces raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque and assaulted worshippers inside. Observers say Israel has declared war against Palestinians because they have dared to resist its colonial projects and demand freedom. However, amid its failure to silence the Palestinians during its aggression against Gaza, Israel escalates mass arrests, thinking it might bring them to their knees. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
The war of words between former top aide Dominic Cummings and the British Prime Minister has intensified. In a volley of tweets on the weekend, Cummings described Britain's early plan to combat the coronavirus pandemic as a disaster. Perhaps the most contentious of his allegations, the Johnson government's initial official strategy in March last year to achieve herd immunity without a vaccine. In other words, to let the virus rip through the population in order for people to build natural immunity, an allegation the government denies.
And you now admit as government that herd immunity was the policy until March?
Not at all, no. Absolutely not. Our policy, from the outset, Andrew, the policy and the strategy...
So why is Dominic Cummings telling us that that's true?
Well, I can't speak for Mr. Cummings.
When he was fired last year, Cummings took a large amount of documents with him, allegedly proving his allegations. He will appear in the British Parliament on May 26, where he is expected to present what he has called crucial historical evidence.
But Dominic Cummings to come out now and say he doesn't... He believes this is a word, that was a word of rubbish and it was dangerous... begs the question, why didn't he say that now, when he was in a position advising the government?
But why has Cummings, who played an important role in Boris Johnson's successful 2019 election campaign and was also the architect of Britain's campaign to leave the European Union, lashing out at his former boss?
He feels extremely sore, having been sacked from his position as Boris Johnson's chief advisor. So I think there's a question of personal revenge does come into it. But how far does he really want to push this? Does he want to push it to is in danger of toppling Boris Johnson? I suspect not.
Three lockdowns, more than 128,000 deaths, and a deep economic slump since the start of the pandemic. The British Prime Minister has hailed his government's vaccination program as a success. The question now is whether that parliamentary committee put Boris Johnson's security of tenure ahead of his responsibility for allowing the COVID-19 outbreak to soar in communities across the UK in the spring and summer of last year. Saeed Puriza, London.
Public outpouring against Israel in Pakistan. The streets of the megacity of Karachi flooded with protesters in solidarity with Palestinians. There is no letup to anti-Israel protest in this 220 million populated Muslim country after Israel attacked and desecrated Islam's third holiest site in the eastern Jerusalem Al-Quds and imposed a unilateral war on Gaza. The huge collateral and human losses in the latest round of one-sided war imposed on unarmed Palestinians has once again become a rallying point to unify people from all segments of the society in Pakistan to join hands to protest against Israel.
We thank to Allah. Today, people in every Muslim country stand by Palestinians. And by God willing, we would continue our war against Israel until we liberate Al-Quds Mosque.
The anti-Israel protests have been swelling in Pakistan despite a fragile ceasefire between Israel and Hamas administration in Gaza. Pakistan's government is feeling the heat of public pressure, which is reflected in country's foreign minister's rare and blunt remarks about Western media outlets on how they have been whitewashing war crimes of Israel against Palestinians.
Israel is losing out. They're losing the media war despite their connections. They are losing the media war. The tide is turning.
What are their connections?
Deep pockets.
What does that mean?
Well, they're very influential people. I mean, they control media.
I would call that an anti-Semitic remark.
Pakistan has rejected criticism of pro-Israeli lobbies and Western media, claiming that country's foreign minister's remarks were anti-Semitic. On the contrary, foreign minister's analogy about nexus between Israel and Western media has been welcomed across the Muslim world. Islamabad says the Western media has been covering up the massacre of Palestinians by propagating it as Israel's right of self-defense. On the other hand, whenever leaders of the Muslim countries speak truth about Israel's aggression and apartheid state's overgrown influence on Western media to whitewash its war crimes, they call it anti-Semitic. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Bishop Talbot Swan, a highly respected civil rights activist, expressed the sympathy and solidarity among the African American community for the Palestinians as outrage over Israel's actions has continued to grow.
If any people should resonate with what's going on in Palestine, it's black people in America. Even when we look at what's happening on the streets in our nation, many police departments across America actually go to Israel to be trained by the military in so-called counterterrorism strategies. And then they come here into black communities and employ those strategies on black citizens. So we fully understand their struggle. It resonates with us, and we stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people.
For many, the fact the U.S. government funds Israel while reparations owed to black Americans have yet to be paid is hypocritical.
They can find nearly $4 billion a year to give to Israel, but they can't find any money to give to African Americans who descended from enslaved Africans. It's a travesty. It's a shame. And we're not asking for a handout. We're not asking for you to do us a favor. That's money that is owed. That's a debt that the United States has yet to pay.
Like many faith leaders, Bishop Swan reiterated his continued support for the Palestinians in the face of racist apartheid.
Oppressed people all over the world are watching what's happening. We are standing in solidarity with you. We are pushing and pressing for governmental structures to condemn the violence, to stop the funding of terrorism, because that's exactly what it is, and we want them to remain steadfast, to be strong, and to know that we are behind them.
The demands for the U.S. to stop funding Palestinian oppression and to implement justice for black America will continue as long as the status quo remains in place.
Support for the Palestinians has undoubtedly intensified, with millions of people around the world condemning Israel, demanding an end to the occupation of Palestine. Richard Sudam, London.
With less than a month to go until the presidential election in Iran, people are discussing about the policies the next president must follow to solve the problems. out of over 400 contenders, about 40 heavyweight ones, claim their number one goal is to solve economic problems that have been growing during the past years. In order to see how these plans are feasible, we talked to some lawmakers regarding the objectives every hopeful must have in mind.
In every election, the economy is of great significance to people, especially at a time they've experienced tough times in the face of economic issues. Hopefuls make promises, but people must be watchful not to pin hope on their slogans. Their slogans must have a logical basis. In my opinion, what the country needs in terms of economy is a look at international capabilities. Of course, the sanctions are biting, but we can't say all our economic problems are because of the sanctions. Most of our economic issues are the result of not paying attention to domestic capabilities.
Another lawmaker told us the most important things the president must follow are transparency and accountability.
People expect the runners to be honest with them. They say the next president must have a comprehensive plan for the economic issues. It means the result of their plans must be seen in the economic basket of the families. Within the past 8 years, the government was waiting for decisions to be made outside the country. The next president should fight against corruption and injustice.
The MPs stressed that having good relations with the world for economic improvement is a must, but each country should rely on its own capabilities.
The livelihood of people and solving economic problems is the main slogan of most of the hopefuls for the 13th presidential election of Iran. They also say that they have detailed plans to improve the life quality of people. Human Abedi, Tehran.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi, kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness. And I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive. And make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans. And muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
Debate.
Hello, welcome to the debate. I'm Kaba Tahway. Violence has once again erupted in the occupied Palestinian territories. Israeli forces have attacked Palestinians protesting against the planned eviction of several families from their homes in East Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Why does this continue after Israel suffered a humiliating defeat at the hands of the resistance fighters and the rockets that came from the Gaza Strip? In this debate, we'll discuss the tense situation that remains in Jerusalem, Al-Quds, while the U.S. Secretary of State is visiting the region. First, let's cross on over to the occupied Ramallah. Ana Cantillo is our correspondent joining us in order to find out what is going on there. Ramallah, obviously tensions still remain there. Tell us what neighborhoods, what's going on, and what has transpired.
Well, what's happening, the same case of Palestinians living in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in East Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Today, Israeli court in Jerusalem, Al-Quds, postponed its decision on an appeal lodged by seven Palestinian families from Batn al-Hawa neighborhood in Silwan in East Jerusalem, Al-Quds. The Israeli court have decided that 86 Palestinian families should leave their homes, or mainly their homes would be expelled out from their homes in Batn al-Hawa neighborhood in order to allow for Israeli settlers to live in their homes. As you have mentioned, Palestinians have protested outside the court today against the Israeli ruling. However, the Israeli forces have attacked the Palestinian families and the protesters protesters who were supporting the families in the families from Batn al Hawa neighborhood. The Israeli regime claims that these homes are owned by Jewish settlers from the Ataret Kohenim Foundation. This foundation works to strengthen a Jewish presence in East Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and those Palestinian families used to live in the old town of Jerusalem, Al-Quds, in 1965 before the occupation of the eastern part of Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and then they moved to Batn al-Hawa. Now the Israeli settlers want to occupy their homes and to expel them from their homes. The court have postponed the hearing. However, another hearing could be expected in the coming weeks, like the situation of Sheikh Jarrah residence.
Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. Mona Kandila talking to us from occupied Ramallah. Our guest joining us for this debate, we have Danijel Jejic, who's an author and researcher, joining us from Beirut. And we also have Richard Becker, author of Palestine, Israel, and the U.S. Empire. I'd like to welcome you both. Danijel Jejic, let me first start with you. Looking at the tensions, as our correspondent just explained, of how it still exists, and also Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, included in this, major flashpoints before the war broke out. Why do you think Israel continues with these evictions, which have resulted in clashes, not to mention the possibility of it breaking out into another war? If we want to have a flashback here, the evictions in courts were actually postponed when Israel saw the height of the violence that broke out, at the height where there were lots of clashes taking place.
If you look at the structure of Israel's policies, it pretty much depends on these so-called evictions and the continued expulsion of Palestinians, because the official goal of the policy is, of course, to remove Palestinians, who are the indigenous people, from not only Jerusalem, but from all of Palestine, in order to increase settlement activities and to increase the colonies and the colonization of Palestine. Now, it's continuing, of course, because to some extent, after the so-called ceasefire, the topic has, to some extent, disappeared from the diplomatic discourse and from much of the media reporting in the West, so that there is less attention being paid to the continuity of these actions. But they haven't started recently, and they're not going to stop, because it is a continuous, a structural ethnic cleansing that the Israeli regime is conducting in East Jerusalem and beyond.
We hear about that, Richard Becker, like the words that I guess they're used, ethnic cleansing. Amnesty International coming out saying that these eviction orders, another example of what they say is Israel's criminal policy of forced displacement of Palestinians. What are the Israelis exactly doing? What is their main purpose behind these evictions, and what they're exercising there on the ground?
Well, there's one main objective on part of the Israeli government. There are many tactics that that pursue this objective, but the objective is to remove as many of the Palestinians from Palestine as possible. That's their objective. Their objective, and they even talked about this in the days right after the 1967 war. It's been documented by the Israeli historian Ilan Pape that in the cabinet meetings that took place at that time, there was a discussion going on about how Israel could now annex the West Bank that it had just conquered in a surprise attack on Syria, Jordan, and Egypt. Along with, they also had taken over Gaza at that time. But they had this idea, how can we annex the land without the people and not annex the people? So this has been going on for a very, very long time. And I think it's taken a long time for the world to see it. But in these particularly grotesque incidences where the settlers show up in East Jerusalem, which was under Jordanian rule at the time, up until the 1967 war, and claim that even though the Palestinians who lived there have lived there for generations now in Silwan and Sheikh Jarrah, that somehow the settlers have a right to take their land. And this is backed up by the courts, it's backed up by the police, it's backed up by the military, and it's backed up by the Israeli government itself. And that's what the objective is. If the objective is to ethnically cleanse the area and replace the Palestinian, the indigenous people, with those who have come to settle in what they call Israel.
Well, Daniel, we are looking at the Palestinian factions and Hamas just in the past days. They have held their celebratory occurrences that they've had on a number of occasions, marking this very important milestone that they have seen as a success in terms of the ceasefire happening and in terms of the rockets and the point, the goal that they had, which resulted in that ceasefire. Now, they have issued a warning because of the clashes that happened, that began that war, ultimately, in Al-Quds. I don't know if you recall, they issued a warning, and they said by 6 p.m., if Israel doesn't stop what it's doing, which included the evictions also at Sheikh Jarrah, that they were going to fire the rockets. Israel is still continuing doing what it's doing. Isn't Israel afraid that there may be rocket attacks coming from the Gaza Strip, and then we then go back to square one here?
It's a good question. I mean, in fact, when we look at the structure of all of this, I think it's inevitable at some point, because Israel's policies are violent in their structure. So they are violating Palestinian human rights and are continuously evicting people and expelling them from their homes. It would be difficult to imagine that they wouldn't be expecting any sort of reaction, but I guess one of the major issues that they face, as you mentioned, and with the victory that Hamas claimed, is of course a question how Israel is going to react to that and whether it would make a difference for them, because effectively these policies are going to continue and they're recreating new forms of containment and control to contain Palestinians. But of course there is a rise in so-called tension now that it's in many ways unprecedented.
Richard Becker, if we want to take a look at the U.S. now, we know that the U.S. Secretary of State is in the region. He's staying here, I guess, in the region for a number of days. No surprise that he has claimed his complete support for Israel, the U.S.'s complete support, that Israel has a right to defend itself. His trip is meant to, according to how the news is meant to have the ceasefire hold. When we take a look at the importance that the U.S. has placed, this trip being one example of it, a quick question comes to mind, aside from the support that the U.S. has said it's going to give to Gazans, to Palestinians, that it's going to rebuild the relationship, it's going to reopen a consulate in Jerusalem, give millions in aid to help the Gaza Strip. Why doesn't it come out and lift the blockade on the Gaza Strip and ask Israel to do that?
Well, I think that we can see that Secretary of State Blinken in his trip, you know, repeating that familiar mantra, you know, that all of them say in Washington, Israel has a right to defend itself. They never say that the Palestinians have a right to defend themselves when they're being attacked by settlers or being attacked by, you know, mass police forces or the military in the West Bank or the airstrikes on Gaza. They never use that expression in regard to the Palestinians. But clearly they are very worried. I think Washington is very worried right now about, you know, the Palestinians have been kind of counted out. The Abraham Accords, we're just going to go around the Palestinians and the Palestinian people and solve all the problems in the Middle East and not have to take them into account. And what, in a certain way, I think is the most important thing that just happened, in addition to the joining in on a mass scale of Palestinians from inside the 1948 borders of Israel, is that the Palestinians affirmed once again that they will not be sidelined, they will not be left out of what's going on. So now the U.S. reaction to that, Blinken and Biden and all the rest of them, is to now rush in and try to rescue, now having to take into account that the Palestinians are not going away and not going to be sidelined, to try to strengthen the organization that the U.S. most supports in the region, which is the Palestinian Authority under Mahmoud Abbas, which has lost a great deal of credibility over a long period of time, but I think especially in regard to the events that just took place. So They're saying, well, we're going to help rebuild Gaza, but we're not going to deal with Hamas. Well, Hamas is the governing party, and how is that going to work? Well, they're going to, I think what they'll try to do is go around dealing with Hamas, for sure. But they're doing a number of different things right now, which are intended to try to bolster the Abbas government and the Palestinian Authority.
Well, Daniel Judge, we had the senior leader of the Palestinian Resistance Movement, Yahya Sinwar, today, say that if the violations against Al-Quds and Palestinians continue, it's not going to think twice about sending rockets into Israel. And he said that there was actually a plan to send, from what he said, about 300 rockets simultaneously into Haifa and Tel Aviv. But that plan was scrapped at the last second due to the depth of the destruction that it would bring, amongst other factors that were taken into consideration. What is that exactly... place Israel in the bigger picture here, and at the same time, what do you think it shows in terms of the, I guess, the depth of the military reach that the Palestinian factions have when it comes to Israel?
Yeah, I think it shows the resilience that the Palestinian factions and Palestinians in general continue to resist, and to resist not only the physical aggression and violence, but also the policies that try to silence them and also police them and police the ways in which they express their resistance. But also from a military perspective, it shows the Zionist regime that it is probably not as strong as it presents itself or thinks it is, and that Palestinians are still there. It also reaffirms the presence of the indigenous people through the settler community, and to some extent continues also the threat that that the colony poses, which is effectively based on a very fragile narrative, and it's a highly militarized society that, after all, is there as a colony, whereas Palestinians are, of course, both if we, the factions you mentioned, but also just in general, have, I guess, to an extent, also the will to survive on their land and to return. So even here, the intentions of confrontation are very different among Palestinians and for the Zionist regime, and I think this is what continues to weaken the Zionist regime in many ways.
Yeah, Richard Becker, this the senior leader of the Palestinian Resistance Movement, Yahya Sinwar, also made another very interesting comment when he was addressing Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, and I do have to mention that Israel actually has a an announcement that it made that it would have a hit out on Yahya Sinwar. So he is obviously being very bold and coming out, actually making himself present in the way they did it. Anyways, he said that when asked or when addressing how all this will end, how the Palestinian resistance factions and Hamas would stop with rocket attacks, with their hostility, he said all Israel has to do is to follow the UN resolutions. And when you think about that, it's an international body that issued those resolutions. How likely is it for Israel to follow any of those resolutions?
As long as Israel has the protection of the United States, because this is very important, is that it's not just, I mean, the $3.8 billion or more a year that goes to the State of Israel in military aid is very important. There's other monies that flow from the United States from private sources as well. So that's important. But I think even more important is that Israel is under the U.S. Umbrella of protection. It's part of the U.S. empire. The book that I did, Palestine, Israel, and the U.S. Empire, was premised on that idea that really Israel is a vital cog in the U.S. military machine. The world, it's a very big world out there, and you know, the U.S. is trying to dominate the entire globe. It has military commands for the entire globe, but it doesn't have the forces on its own. It needs some allies who are subject to it, and it has them, and Israel is one, and Israel is right in the center of the Middle East. You know, I think it's in the center of the Middle East in a geographical sense, and I think it's in the center of the Middle East in terms of the consciousness of the Arab people and the other peoples of the Middle East. And so what happens there is very, very important, and I think that's another reason why we see Blinken over there now, is that they know that what happens to the Palestinians, what happens in occupied Palestine, has the potential to very much affect the entire region.
Yeah, one of the most interesting things, Daniel, when it comes to the relationship between Israel and the U.S. is this military aid that our guest there, Richard Becker, talked about. And when you think about it, the U.S. gives Israel military aid. The string attached to that is that it needs to purchase its military equipment from the U.S. So when you put things into context, when you have a war that we just did, that they just had, and you have the Iron Dome missile system, have these rockets coming from the Gaza Strip that the interceptors need to go out in order to thwart it or to block it, each one of those costs between $50,000 to $100,000. Just one example of how the U.S. in turn has its military manufacturers make the money that it's indirectly, again, sending in the form of military aid. Not much of an incentive for the U.S. to want to stop a war that it's making money from.
Absolutely. And I mean, in many ways, Israel is a proxy for the United States, and Palestine, in particular Gaza, has been turned into a laboratory where weapons are tested. There is a very strong exchange, not just in military, but also in police tactics and strategies of policing weapons, as you mentioned, between the United States and the Zionist regime. So there is an economic and military component that is very important for both of them, and also informs the very existence of that relationship. So definitely it does provide a benefit if there is a continuous, shall I say, usage of those mechanisms that are being invested in.
Yep, Richard Becker. Just interviewed Richard Falk days ago, the former special coordinator for the Palestinian territories. I don't know if you recall who he is. What he said, yes, about this topic of U.S. military aid, U.S. equipment being used by Israel in the Gaza Strip was very interesting. He said that Israel actually uses new equipment that the U.S. sells it on the Gaza Strip in the wars in particular, like the one that just passed. And he said that some of this new technology that's being used or new equipment that's being used is then sold or resold, I should say, to other countries. So it profits from experimenting with this new equipment and technology in the war. And that's pretty fascinating in a negative sense if you think about it.
Yeah, and you know, if you go to Washington, D.C., and just next to it is Crystal City, and Crystal City is right by the Pentagon, and Crystal City has Raytheon and Boeing and McDonnell Douglas, and all their offices, these bright, shiny offices are there, and there's a revolving door. And so they got close with the Pentagon so that they don't have to walk too far to get to the revolving door. Of generals and admirals and lobbyists and executives from the military. So it's all tied together there. Of course, this is, and it's very, very true that for a long time, the U.S. has had Israel test out some of its new weapon systems on the Palestinians or on Lebanon as well. And so this has been going on a long time. It's corrupt and immoral and unjust in every way that you can think of it. But that's the reality of the situation.
Okay, my final question goes to you, Daniel, if you can, briefly. What is next here? We know that Israel is on the back foot in a sense. The ceasefire is not something that Hamas has said that they wanted to do, but they weren't the ones that requested it. They said it's an unconditional ceasefire. Israel is now looking weak on the international stage because of the condemnations. So what can we expect here to happen?
Good question. I mean, we had similar situations before, I think not to that extent, but I think that the diplomatic discourse and the media narratives play an important role. Having less attention being paid to Israel and its actions obviously gives it more space to continue those, but also Israel is confronted with a resistance that is organized not only in Palestine but beyond in the region, where various resistance movements are coordinating and have been coordinating with the Palestinian resistance. So Israel is definitely facing threats that it hasn't faced before. So it would probably have to extend its support on the United States. It remains to be seen what was going to happen, but it does definitely have to. I mean, Israel didn't really have a strategy when it was bombarding Gaza other than just bombarding people and killing them. And in the long run, of course, it needs to be seen what's going to happen. But I think it is faced with a resistance that is stronger than it was before.
Thank you for that. We appreciate it. Danijel Jedic, author and researcher. I'd like to thank Richard Becker, also author of Palestine, Israel, and the U.S. Empire. And we had correspondent Monica Ndil at the top of the debate. That does it for this edition of the debate. When we cover Taiwan, the entire team is goodbye until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Voter suppression bill currently being considered by the Texas legislature would decrease the number of polling locations in districts that are traditionally Democratic and non-white, while increasing the locations in Republican and predominantly white districts. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Sharon Jung Ryder. This article is published under the heading, New Texas Bill Reduces Polling Locations in Blue and Non-White Districts. Stay tuned for the details, please. Voter suppression will currently being considered by the Texas legislature would decrease the number of polling locations in districts that are traditionally Democratic and non-white, while increasing the locations in Republican and predominantly white districts.
Now Republicans are targeting those very places in an elections bill. SB 7, applying a formula to redistribute polling locations in the state's five most populous counties that the Texas Tribune has found would disproportionately affect voters in Democratic communities. In Harris County, which houses Houston, all but two of the area's 15 Democratic districts would see a decrease in polling locations thanks to the new formula. District 141, which is also home to the largest portion of non-white people of voting age of any other district in the county, white people make up only 10.6% of the population of voting age there, would be hit the hardest, losing 11 polling places. All of the districts in Harris County that would be losing polling places are represented by the Democrats. Meanwhile, every district represented by a Republican would either not see a change or would gain polling locations. All of those districts have white voting age populations of 45% or more, according to census data. The Texas Tribune analysis also finds similar trends in other counties. In Tarrant County's District 90, which is represented by a Democrat and where 77% of the population is either Latino or Black, voters would lose half of the polling locations they had in 2020. SB 7 would also implement a number of other voting restrictions, such as limiting the distribution of absentee ballots, allowing for more voter roll purges, and limiting early voting with provisions like banning drive-through voting. The bill, if signed into law, would make Texas one of the hardest states in the county for citizens to exercise their right to vote. State lawmakers are currently ironing out the final details of the bill, after which it will have to clear a vote again in the Senate and the House. The GOP controls both chambers of the legislature and the governor. Greg Abbott is a Republican. Though the election bill will affect millions of voters in the state, Republicans have shrouded the process of writing and amending the bill in secrecy. The committee currently making amendments to the bill is doing so behind closed doors, much to the dismay of many voting rights advocates. Republican Representative Briscoe Kane also previously tried to rush the voting restriction bill out of committee without listing it on the committee's agenda, giving journalists no notice of the bill's movement and the public no chance to comment on it. Kane has said that the bill isn't about voter suppression in his opinion. "I believe it is voter enhancement," he said this month of the bill, "that would make it harder for people of color to vote." The bill, which Kane has sponsored, also has language plucked straight out of Jim Crow, including phrases that suggest it is necessary to preserve the purity of the ballot box. Republicans have been quite open with their goals in this year's wave of voter suppression laws. They are trying to engineer situations so that Republicans can't lose elections again. In March, an Arizona lawmaker said that the GOP is passing such laws because everybody shouldn't be voting. The GOP has been passing voter suppression laws at record pace, introducing hundreds over the course of just a few months. Democrats, both at the Senate and federal level, have been trying to stem the tide, but Republicans are forging ahead, especially in states where they control the governorship and the legislature.
Before the Texas House passed a version of SB 7 earlier this month, Democrats fought the legislation through the night, introducing 130 amendments to the bill. And at the federal level, Democrats are trying to pass the Four People Act, which would drastically expand voting access, but the Senate filibuster stands in its way.
From the heart of beautiful Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.